subject is who's afraid of pheromones? And most of you aren't right now, but before the evening's out, you probably will be. Because it's kind of a hazardous stuff. I have to get my props out. My name is Leo Busted, and I'm the local sheep herder and bird watcher. And during my many times to Holden over the last 15 years, and I've lost count of how many times this is, I have attempted to discuss mind-expanding subjects. Subjects that maybe you don't always read about in the daily papers, but are what I consider very, very important things for you to know. Some of these subjects have ranged from cancer, which I've worked a good deal on, experimental animals, the use of animals to study diseases of people that would also help the animals, energy and energy effluence, nutrition, food safety, and one of my favorite subjects, pigs, which I talked about the other night, but almost every speech I talk about pigs. Tonight will not be an exception. For the first time, for any group at Holden, I'm discussing the subject of pheromones. And I have to, I'll give you some background to this so you'll understand where I'm coming from. I guess I was sort of average or so on. As far as observations goes, I was raised on a farm, and I was always amazed at how the I try to hide from my dog, and there could be a lot of people running back and forth, and the trail could be all messed up, but the dog would always find me. And I often wondered about that, just how he could do that. And in the sheep business, if you had some little lambs and they died, and then maybe another ewe had three lambs, and for those of you who are not sheep is not your common vernacular. They only have two spigots, and three sheep create a problem. So you say, well, we got this ewe that just lost her lambs. We just put the third one on here. But that ewe probably won't take it. She'll butt it away. She always checks it. Whenever a lamb nurses a ewe, she reaches around just to check them. And she's not just looking at their rear quarters. She's smelling them. And if they don't smell right, they don't belong to her. And so went through a lot of techniques. You can prove this, of course, scientifically. You can make them anosmic. You can cut the nerve to the olfactory lobe so they can't smell. Or you can put something on the sensitive cells in the nose that compromise it, and then they won't be able to tell the difference. We use other means, though. We might skin out the dead lamb and put it over the new lamb, and then put it up there. And sheep aren't exactly their IQ is below detection. And you can make kind of a nice suit out of the little lamb's coat and put it over the new lamb, and the ewe kind of looks around there and smells again, but you know, it smells like her old lamb. Or you can put gasoline on her nose or kerosene and on the lamb, and that kind of crosses her up. So you go to things like that. But the point of it is, there was something going on here. Now, I have discussed in this place, and one of the great interests of mine not for research, but an interest, is how animals communicate. I've talked about non-human primates communication here, and usually emphasizing visual and auditory, you know, noise. We like noise and seeing things and hearing things. And that's the communication we say, boy, that's the way to go. Well, it isn't very precise. If I whispered to you something here and we passed it around, I wouldn't recognize it by the time it came around. But if I had a pheromone here for certain animals, that's a very specific thing. It's a remarkable piece of a method of communication. In fact, this is such an important subject, and I'm going to expand your mind tonight, and then I'm going to make some proposals. If we erased all pheromones, animals would be completely disorganized and essentially be the end of them. That's how important it is. Now, the word pheromone comes from the Greek pherein, pherein, which means to carry, and hormon rhymes with Norman, which means to excite or to stimulate. So they put them together and call it pheromone. They used to call them, over 20 years ago, they called these things ectohormones. Let me give you a little physiological lesson here. One of my disciplines is physiology. And when the Conrads and the Fellmans knew me at Hanford, we did a lot of studies in rheobiology and physiology. And one of my interests then was the some of the hormones. And they are defined as an agent that's elaborated by a gland in the body, and it's the material that's secreted acts on another part of the body, and it gets there via usually the blood. For example, and one of my interests was the thyroid gland, which is in your throat here, and it secretes, among other things, thyroxin, triiodothyronine, which is secreted into the blood, and it affects you at varying times in different ways during your lifespan. So that's the definition of a hormone. Well, an ectohormone isn't really right, because it's true, it works on the outside, but it's a material that's elaborated from the outside that doesn't act on this individual, but another individual of the species, okay? So if I emit something, it's recognized by another member of the species. And how this came into being, the first interest was in the insects, is for several reasons, which may become evident as I proceed. And they classify these into about three forms. Those that are called stimulatory, there's various names for them, or releaser. And a releaser type pheromone, if a given animal detects it, it acts almost immediately on it through the central nervous system. There's another one called a primer, and it doesn't act directly. It acts, it might enter, it may be tasted or into the nasal area. It's olfactory, but it acts through maybe the pituitary gland or something else to cause an effect that way, and it's usually slower. And then there's another one called the imprinting one, and I'm not going to discuss that because I don't know very much about it. I will suggest two things that might apply here. And as you might suspect, one of them is on a pig. How long does a pig remember? That's a good question. Or how long does a dog remember? I remember Lute. Lute was a dog that was owned by one of my close friends in veterinary school when I was going through veterinary school. We used to study together, and at that time I used to hunt. I don't anymore, but we used to hunt with Lute, and so we had a lot of good times with Lute. And he graduated. Well, both Lute and Jack graduated. And they went to Hood River. Now, I didn't see either Lute or Jack or Gene and all the kids for 2 years. And the chief and the kids went on home, and I sort of went down by and seen Jack, and I drove into the farmyard, and I got out of the car, and Lute came, and Lute just went crazy. And she slept by my bed the 2 nights I was there. I came back again the next year, and then I guess it was 2 years, and each time Lute just went crazy. Well, apparently my pheromone or my smell was imprinted on her. Now that doesn't fully meet the definition of pheromone because it's a different species if you think veterinarians are not dogs. Now pigs are a little closer, and a lot of, there's a question I've had, how long does a pig remember? Because I worked with pigs a lot and they do remember a long time. There was one pig that a fellow sort of grew up with when it was very young, and they were very good friends, and he didn't see the pig then for 7 years. By this time the pig is an ugly boar. I mean, it's mean, and people didn't dare go into the pen with it. And he came and he asked where the old boar, where his old friend was, the old boar, and he says he's over there, and before they could tell him, he jumped into the pen. They were horror struck. And the old pig came charging at him, stopped short of him, and nuzzled him. Because he remembered, it was imprinted on him. See? But I don't know if that's an imprinting one or not, but that's all I'm going to say about them. Now, what kind of actions do these things have? Well, some pheromones identify a given individual or a species. And it's a common one. I guess with rabbits, God made so many of them. And as I go through here, you realize what a great architect is on this job. It's absolutely blow your mind. But I guess there's so many rabbits, so they sort of had a common marking for rabbits. But it isn't true for a lot of them. Some of them are singly labeled. There's another pheromone that will cause them to group. Emitted, they form together. There's another one that will cause dispersal, and I'll bring out some of the reasons why. There's another one that will cause aggression. Another one will tell them how to behave with the opposite sex, and how to ascertain what is the opposite sex, which is also important today. And how to organize members of the society in a certain rank. It respects class, your class ranking. They respect dominance, and it also marks out the boundaries of the real estate, the territory. Enemies can be frightened by it, confused by it. Friends are attracted and enchanted. Now, with this introduction then, I thought that I would approach this phylogenetically. That is, I'll take you through the species. And we'll start at the lower forms. And a good, I've already gone into the techniques that one might use. I think I did. That we can, but I failed to mention one. You can cut some of the nerves and make an animal anosmic. That is, that it cannot smell. Or you can wipe out the sensitive cells that detect smell in the nose. Or you can bypass the sensitive area in the nose. They've done this in bulls, where they pass an endotracheal tube. They'll put a tube with a cuff on it down into the trachea, and you blow up the cuff so that they can breathe back and forth, but none of the exhaled or inhaled air goes by the nasal cavity, so they can't smell, see what's going on. So these are usually the techniques that have been utilized for this. Now, we'll move on to the protozoa. Protozoa are one-celled animals. And they have a pheromone that that disperses, and when there's plenty of food, this obtains, so they're dispersed then. You don't get too close. You're eating your own chow around here. When the chow is depleted, they emit a hormone that congeals them and put them together like a slug. And this material is identified. And I should point out, you know, why didn't they think of all this before? Why haven't we come on to this before? The reason we haven't is that some of the techniques for detecting these very sensitive and small amounts has only recently come into our technology with gas chromatography and all these other means. We have some exceedingly sensitive means now for detection of these materials, which we've come, obviously, we go through. Now, insects are probably the most studied. And there are several reasons for this. It's most highly developed in insects because a lot of them live in the dark, in burrows, and you know, you can't say, hey, you with the blue hat on, because it's like somebody that's black shoveling coal at midnight. You can't really make them out, you know, what's going on. So that figures that you'd have to use some other means. And it's very highly developed in them. And the bee is one of the interesting ones. I should point out, though, that it's interesting that in most species, in the lower forms, they don't identify individuals. Except in the only one case I know of, is the desert wood louse. And they pair up for life. How about that? They pair up for life, and they have burrows, and they have a pheromone that identifies them, each one, so that If somebody else comes in, another louse comes in, trying to louse things up, they know by the smell that they're not one of them, which is kind of a handy arrangement, I guess. Kind of keeps the family intact. And the honeybee is pretty interesting. I don't know if you've studied the organization of the honeybee. The queen bee produces a substance in her body, a pheromone, which when consumed by the workers' worker bees, of course, groomer, and they, of course, consume it during that time, and this suppresses the development of the ovaries in these bees. And this prevents competition. Now, this also affects the workers' bees so that they behave a certain way when they feed on royal jelly. And they feed this royal jelly to the growing larvae, but they only feed it for them for 2.5 days. But when the queen bee gets old, the amount of this pheromone is depleted, so that they get sort of out of kilter, so that they keep feeding this royal jelly for longer. And what ends up with is that you get another queen bee developing, and she will either leave or take over. And this same pheromone does act on her so that she attracts a male in flight, and she mates in flight, and she also emits a pheromone that keeps the colony together, so they, if she gets lost, they can still hone in on her. Ants are also a fantastically interesting one. They secrete, and I should say that these compounds that are secreted are exceedingly simple compounds. I could write them on the board, but probably wouldn't do that much good. But just take it from me that it's usually 10 carbon atoms, some maybe not much less than that, and this is all figured out too, and I won't go into it, and maybe up to 15 or 20. And this is all figured out, so they're not too heavy, but they're not too light, and you can get all kinds of combinations. Fantastic number of combinations. And a formic acid type of thing that's emitted by one set of ants. When a foreign ant disturbs a colony and is bitten, this alarm pheromone is released. And this attracts, of course, other ants of this colony in there. And they say, boy, we got to go and help that guy. And it also marks the ant that's bitten. So they say, that's the enemy. And another thing that it does is to It's irritating so that when the enemy is bitten, it also irritates in the bite. That's known as a triple threat. Another kind of an ant is a slave-making ant, and it uses a propaganda substance to disorganize the societies of another species, and so they can capture the immature forms. And what they happen is that these raiding parties, the workers, they reach the victim's nest, guided by an odor trail. You see, a scout ant goes out and he... most of these ants have a ballpoint pen in their stinger, and they're marking the trail. I don't know if they go da 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 did it or what, but it isn't a continual line because they save it. You see, because it's very economical, so they don't have to make one solid line. And the remarkable part of this is that in these slave-making ants, they have a pheromone that what it does, it's an alarm substance for the ants they're going to capture. And it just puts the colony they're attacking in disarray, because this pheromone, it acts on that colony to get them all mixed up. It's kind of a secret weapon. And then, and so while they're scattering them, it's an attraction for the ants that are attacking, so they know what's going on. So it's a pretty handy material.
Is this what God's going to use when the Russians attack Israel?
Well, I'm going to have something to say about that at the end. Yeah, I got a lot of ideas. When I get to be dictator, I'm going to do it with smells. I'll tell you about this organization in a little while. Now, fire ants, too, are very important, very interesting. And you've all seen ants that, you know, they find something sweet or something, and they'd run a trail. And they're all making the same trail, aren't they? They're all following the same trail. What happens on this is, like the fire ant, it'll go out, and it'll find some food. And if it's more food than what he can handle, say it's a big hunk of something, why he'll grab a piece of it, and then he'll come charging back home. Maybe he's marked his trailer, maybe he hasn't, but he'll put out a certain pheromone, and then he's got his ballpoint pen on, marking away, and as soon as he gets back to the nest, the rest of the ants recognize this, and so they take off. And they follow this trail, and of course, it's just like homing in, you see. And they go there, and they find food too. And the more food is there, the more ants go there, and the heavier the trail is, because they're all marking and coming back, you see. So it becomes very intense, so that attracts more and more of them. But then when they run out, they don't mark the trail coming back. And the pheromone for them only lasts for 2 minutes. And then it's gone. So they're not wasting a lot of time going down lousy trails that there's no food at the end, you see. It's a very handy arrangement. That's what I mean. It was a good architect. Now, these fire ants also have another thing that kind of worries me. They also put out what is the equivalent sort of a pheromone when they die. It takes a little while. They're laying there and they don't pay attention to them, but as they decompose, they emit a substance which signals the ants. They all grab him. They grab a little, each a hunk of them. They carry him down and put him in the, they got a burial place, a garbage sort of thing for dead ants. Now, some of these mad scientists have extracted that material, and they put it on some of the live ants. And here they are, then, these live ants, you know, the pallbearers, they come in there and they grab the ant, haul him off to the garbage pit and dump him off there, and he's hollering all the way, "You turkeys, you know, I'm still alive." But he doesn't know how to, he doesn't have a pheromone for that, you see. He gets the garbage pit, he comes charging back. The pallbearers recognize him. He's still got the smell on. They haul him off to the garbage dump. And this goes on until it finally is dissipated. In the meantime, he's gotten awful angry. And he's gotten a free ride some ways. See, what I'm afraid of is they'll find that for old deans, you see, and they'll keep going. Now, on ants, and I think I've probably done enough with the ants, except there's one thing. There's a blind snake that lives on a certain ant. And unfortunately for the ants, it homes in on their pheromone. So even though he's blind, he detects the pheromone of the ants, and too bad for the ants. Well, I have one other thing. I was going to text, because there's some people from Texas here. There is a Texas leaf-cutting ant. And it's no, as you might expect from Texas, it goes a long ways. Some of these fire ants don't go so far. But these fellows go up hundreds of meters. And they might have a certain feed source for many months. So their pheromone is a different type, and it probably lasts a little longer. There's also I should also say that in many of these ants, there are probably about 10 pheromones that secreted that control the whole colony. And I don't know if you've ever studied the social organization of ants, but it's a fantastic thing. It's a truly fantastic thing. Well, there are many of the insect forms. I should also tell about stingless bees. They can find a source of food, and they have scouts. They send the scouts out, and if they find a good source of food, he emits a pheromone, and he on the way home, he'll stop along the way and mark it at so many places so that the other bees can then go along until they find it and thereby mark where the food is. Another interesting phenomenon has to do with moths. And this has also been utilized. As we proceed here, you'll see that some of these have been used industrially now, and they're very valuable in this regard. There's a material called bombycol from the it's from the silkworm. It forms a moth, of course, and this is a sex attractant, and it's effective in very small amounts. In fact, a single molecule of it will tremble the hairs of any male within miles and send him upwind in confusion of ardor. It has been determined that if a given female moth excreted all of her bombycol in one fell swoop, which is 0.01 microliter, and that's a millionth or a microgram, that would be a millionth of a gram, you see. That's an awful small amount. I'll give you another figure in a minute, but that would should be able to attract, if properly spread out, a trillion males. And it's a tenth of a hundredth of a milligram. A hundredth of a milligram. Now, this is utterly fantastic. In fact, when they were studying this, the people in USDA, working on another one, the gypsy moth, they captured 500,000 gypsy moths to excrete out 20 milligrams, to get 20 milligrams of this stuff. You know, a milligram is a thousandth of a gram. It takes 450 grams to make a pound. So you can get some dimension here. It's just utterly fantastic. The effectiveness of this in very small amounts. And the effect of it varies with these various moths. For example, if you're 1 mile downwind, it only takes a couple of molecules, and first maybe it'll just twitch the antenna, because they have receptors for this material, these chemical receptors on their antenna, cause them to twirl. A little higher dose causes certain body movements. A little higher dose causes the wings to go and they head downwind. And then for the whole mating behavior, then it takes a higher amount. And a given amount, you see, keys a certain reaction. And the difference in from the lowest dose to the highest dose is about a factor of 100,000 to get these various tighter for the action, you see. And what's even more phenomenal, or is almost as, well, I guess it's even more phenomenal to me, is that they can detect wind speeds. And when the wind's blowing real fast, no way, is it? Because whew, it's gone and you haven't got a chance. Or if it's still, you ain't going to get anywhere because it isn't going anyplace. Huh? So they've figured out that from when the wind speed is from between 0 and 4 is the area in which they emit pheromones the most. And as you approach either the 4 or the 0, it falls off. That's also a very handy arrangement. And I should mention in passing here that I mentioned that some of them cause aggregation. And some of you have been troubled by locusts someplace. Well, that's due to a pheromone that assembles the locusts before they take off and after your crops. And there's also, to show you the remarkable properties of some of these pheromones, there is a female snail that emits a pheromone that aggregates the larvae around her, and this pheromone converts the larvae to males, make them males, with which she then mates and produces young. And also, why was the USDA, of course, interested in this gypsy moth stuff? Well, what they use it for, they put it in traps. And you see, it attracts all of these all these moths down there, and maybe it's electrical thing or something. And then when they come into the trap, they've had it, you see. They thought they found a mate, and they're electrocuted, or however they wish to do it. And I've been thinking, if we could get enough of those here, you see, we're raising fish here. And I don't know if you've seen above the pond down here, above them, we have a trap for insects that kills them, and then they fall into the pool of trout, which eat the bugs. The trouble with this is it takes 12 pounds of bugs to get 1 pound of fish. So you need a lot of bugs, and I don't know if we want that many bugs around, but I was just thinking, you know, this might have some, might be something here. And I mentioned too that it's also interesting that some of this is coordinated with plants. That for example, honeybees will go out and they'll find a good source of a material in the market with a pheromone, and some flowers have a similar type chemical in them, so it's attractive to them because of this similarity of the pheromone. See.
Is that why we see 3 bumblebees on all these flowers out here?
It could be. Could be. They do mark. And also, that's why sometimes when bees get mad, when you get bees really mad and they attack someone, they'll sting in the same place, right? Because when they come and sting, they emit a pheromone that aggregates. It calls them in, and so all the others come in here and sting at the same place. Due to the specificity of it. Fish also emit pheromones that identify members of the species, and it also announces stages, because in a lot of fish groups, there's a honcho. He's number one fish, and he's in charge. And he has a different pheromone than the rest of them. And among catfish, if the leader is deposed, if he no longer is leader, he smells different. And they all know it. That might be handy too. And so everybody recognizes he's lost some standing. A bullhead too can immediately identify in water where a recent adversary is by smelling. They smell by running the water over their sensitive cells in their olfactory system. And they can usually distinguish between the fish in the school. And they also, certain fish school? And that's also a pheromone that causes the aggregation of them, maybe for protection, or at night when it's real dark, it leads them through. The firefly, the female of the firefly, one type of firefly, They can mimic the mating signals of females in another genus, and but thereby attract males, and then they eat them up. Now, I have. Now I'm going to talk. I'm going to get into higher forms now. I was going to say that often when I give a talk at Holden through the years, I usually wear a button to signify the lecture. And like when I spoke the other night at Vespers, I had a button that said, "Support your local theologian." And because I was a local theologian, so I needed a lot of support. And then I talked about pigs, and I said, one of them said, "Hogs are beautiful." And the other one was a pig on a psychiatrist's couch. And it says, "Nobody understands me." Tonight I have a button that says, "It's the closest thing I could get to a pheromone, and that's think lutefisk." Now, that's a pretty bad smell unless you really like it, you know. But you can really pick it out from a long ways away. For some of you who don't know what this is, it's kind of a rotten dried cod that Norwegians become addicted to them, and it's even better because in Stanwood, Washington, where I grew up, they used to stack it on the sidewalk, and then the dogs would come along, and by about November it was ready. And then you chop it up and you put it in lye water. Hmm? When you eat lutefisk, you don't do it with silverware because it turns silverware black. Now I'm here to tell you that it's better to think lutefisk than to smell it. Because when you smell lutefisk, you have the next sign which says ufta. That's an expression that's used by Norwegians for a lot of things. In fact, it's a club called the Ufta Club. I think the best definition is, my definition of ufta is when you don't like lutefisk and you smell it. And the other one is when you're the head usher at a big church and you've had three services. And then on the way home, you look down and you find out your fly is open. And you say, "Ufta." Now, we're going to back to pheromones. And I'm going to talk about since a lot of the work on the on pheromones in mammals has been done on rats and mice, and so I dress for the occasion. Can you see this? White colored. I tried to get one for a pig, but I couldn't get one, or I would have wore it the other night with the Greek pride. Now, we got to move along pretty fast here. Most of the behavioral studies have been done on mice and rats among the mammals, and I'm going to tell you about three effects. The first one is the Lee-Boot effect by Lee and Boot, where people are working in the Netherlands, and they found out that mice, female mice, excrete a pheromone when they're aggregated. When there's a lot of them get together, they excrete a pheromone that suppresses their regular estrous cycle, and they go into anestrus. That is, they don't have heat periods. There are so many of them, and the incidence of pseudo false pregnancy increases. And this is called the Lee-Boot effect, and it has some significance, of course, for multiplication, doesn't it? Another one is called the Whitney effect, and this is a very interesting one. It's named after a fellow, Witten, who's a scientist in Australia. And this happens in a lot of farm animals. He first discovered in mice. And when a male mouse or his urine is smelled by a female that is in heat, when a young mouse that's hasn't reached the age where it goes in and has heat periods yet, this will stimulate it to go into cycling. And I'll give you some application for that later when we get to some of the other animals. And another one is called the Bruce effect. And this is a very interesting thing. It's named after Mary Bruce, who works in the she works in the National Institute for Medical Research in Mill Hill, London, and she found out that if two mice mate, and she is then fertilized, but before final implantation of the egg, you introduce a strange male, pregnancy will not develop. It's a very strange thing, but it works, and that's due to a pheromone. She smells this strange male, and she will not then, the egg will not implant. Some people have suggested this might be a good morning after smell. And it's effective in very, very small amounts. There are alarm hormones that probably protect mice from being destroyed. If you electrocute a mouse, or if it gets cold and wet, its urine, the urine from this mouse, will turn off others. They'll avoid it. They'll avoid that mouse or that area, see, so they would be then protected. There's also a certain snail or crustacean that if it's crushed, say in the top of a pool of water, all the others, as soon as that's crushed, they'll take off out of there, they'll go to the bottom of the pond and dig in. That's known as an alarm pheromone. Other male hamsters and other animals will have glands on their flanks. And a lot of animals do this. Some of them mark it with urine. But they also have glands that secrete pheromones that they'll label their territory. And when another male comes in, unless he wants to fight, he'll stay clear of that. And there's also a thing called stink fights. We used to have them when we were kids. At least we sort of called them that. We'd go down in the pasture, you know, and you'd start out kind of friendly-like. You'd pick out dry cow pies and dry horse biscuits, and then you'd start, you know, lobbing them at dogs. And then as the fight got a little worse, you know, you'd start going to fresher and fresher material. We call them stink fights. Of a truth, the lemur, the ring-tail lemur, lemur or lemur, is a monkey-type creature, lives up high, and they actually have stink fights. And they have glands that secrete pheromones, say, on their wrists, and maybe two males get into it, and they'll rub this on their tail, and then they'll whip their tail around like this, you know, hoping that it goes that way, you see, and the other guy is doing the same thing to him. And then they may be charged, and maybe one of them's marked a palm leaf or whatever leaf it is, and the other one comes and marks over it, you know, and it's like those fights we used to have. And that's known as a stink fight, and it's pheromones. Now, you have it on your own. Some of you have cats in your house, and especially males. When you first bring in a male, they'll spray a lot of your furniture, and they're really marking the territory, which causes a problem. We've developed now a chemical, which I won't go into. It's called megasterol acetate, which it seems to negate this. Castration is another way to kind of slow it down. Another thing is catnip. Have you ever watched a cat with catnip? I mean, they go sort of crazy, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, it's probably related.
They
it's probably
roll in it.
They roll in it and go through contortions, and it's really fun to watch. It's probably related to the heat cycle, of the pheromone that appears in the heat cycle. And that's, they feel that's what it is. With dogs, of course, you know that they can track, a male dog can find a female at fantastic distances. And some of this may come from the anal sac, some of it's from the urine. But I won't go much into that because some of you know that already. Cattle pheromones also operate, and I'll throw three of these probably in together here: the cattle and the goats and sheep and pigs, all the same, and they all take the same. So we might as well take the pigs. And you can have some if you have young pigs and you bring in a strange male, you can get those pigs to start cycling a month earlier than if a male isn't around, due to the pheromones from that male pig. They'll cycle early, and I already mentioned that thing in the male and in the mice. I think that we'll move along, except to say it is also used commercially now. Most of you smelled a male pig, a boar pig, and if a lot of times if you get a piece of pork and you cook it, that maybe it's from a male pig that was castrated, but they didn't
wait. May I tell a story about a male pig?
All right.
I had a neighbor who had a boar, and they wanted me to go to an errand for them, and so I had a baby a year and a half old, and they said they'll take care of it if I did this to them. And when I got home, there was the palest looking people. Oh, Ellie, you almost lost Philip today. He was in with the boar, and that pig, he was rubbing a stick on the hindquarters. So they were afraid to go in and get him, but they finally got a courage and went in and saved my. But the boar didn't do anything to that year and a half old baby because he was rubbing the stick on the hindquarters.
He liked it. But that's a very hazardous thing, really. You really could have lost him.
Well, they knew he was.
Yeah, they will attack. But they have a certain smell. And it's very pungent odor, and it becomes very important as I proceed now to remember this. And what they have done now, they have determined what the constituents of this pheromone is that appears in the urine and in some of the apocrine glands of the swine and in the saliva. They've analyzed it, and they have made up, so you can go downtown now and buy this. Now, I should point out that artificial insemination has been used extensively to upgrade cattle, especially dairy cattle and others. It has not worked so well in swine, but it's assisted materially by this material that I've told you about, this material that they extract from male swine, because spraying it into the hog house where the sows are will make it possible that artificial insemination is more effective. So it does really work. Now, what about people? About primates and non-human primates? Well, there is some very interesting data on this. It's just coming out now. It's very limited work. Some people are sort of scared of it, probably. There is indication that we have some anatomical features and our sweat glands and so forth that probably do secrete pheromones. There was a study, I think, at Johns Hopkins, where they studied a number of young ladies in a dormitory. When they came in and they were together in close quarters, they assumed a similar cycle, where they were not had a similar cycle before. This is probably a source of pheromones. Another one is that it was reported in Nature. Nature is probably the most widely read science magazine. It comes out every week out of England. And this fellow made certain observations. I think he was on Malta, and he was shaving every day with an electric shaver, and he weighed his beard. He shaved at the same time every day, tried to shave the same amount, and he was part of the time on his island. He had nobody around him, and he shaved, and then he'd go into town, and he'd be with people and women. And he'd shave then every day too, and he found out that his beard was heavier when he was in association with women. Mm-hmm. This is probably a pheromone. And also, I can cite during the Victorian era, where they kept the women separated as much as they could, their time of puberty was extended. In other words, for some time, so it's maybe some of the same effect as I've described for the mice and some of the other animals. We know that schizophrenic patients are known to have a special odor. They really do. They emit a substance that's different from other people. And women on certain agents are sensitive to certain smells that that varies with their cycle. There's a stabilizing agent the French use in perfumes, and this agent, they've tested quite a few women as a function of their cycle, and at the time of ovulation they are most sensitive to it. And also they also are more sensitive, and their sensitivity varies to this material in boars, in swine. Women are very sensitive to that, and it's a function of their cycle. And this is also a constituent of the urine of males, of male men. So that's about where we are. They're also sensitive to musk. My wife gave me this. It's wild musk. Exotic, uninhibited, mysteriously enticing on the skin. Stroke on all at all pulse points. Throat, elbows, behind the ears. That's hazardous stuff. Maybe she was trying to tell me something. Now, and I should point out too that and they have checked the secretions of certain women and found out that there is a cyclic emission of what would be considered as hormones, which also is observed in certain of the non-human primates. And I should recall for you, if have any of you read the history of Napoleon? Napoleon wrote to Josephine one day, and he said, I suppose he wrote, "Dearest Josephine, I'll be coming in home in 4 days. Don't wash." Now, and that's really true. I would suggest that it might be very disturbing to us to realize that we probably are secrete pheromones, but we're kind of scared of them. And we kind of erase them because we take too many baths. And I was thinking today, is Walt here? Is Walt Capps here?
No.
I'll have to talk to him about this because, he suggested a period of silence. Now, if we use silence but don't take as many baths, we can really get jazzed up. And I have some suggestions for him. In fact, I'm proposing an organization called the State National Institute for Fragrance. The acronym is SNF. And it's going to become bigger than the CIA and the FBI, because I'm going to be able to control the world, really, by getting a lot of these smells produced that could have a remarkable effect on people. And in fact, we are probably reaching the point now where with our scientific equipment, I could put sniffers in here. I can put them in the ball club's halftime quarters, and I can probably tell you by sniffing who's winning and who's losing. I'm going to put them into negotiation sessions at high levels at the UN and bargaining sessions. I can probably tell you how things are going just by the chemical analysis. There's fantastic potential here, and as I said, we're really just getting started. But I think we have an ability to probably control the world if we do this right. But to point out, the thing I want to point out is that just one thing, Chief, and then I'm going to go. She's telling me I got to quit. is that the thing about it is that we're just rubbing two sticks together, and that's true in most of biomedical science today. We're just rubbing two sticks together, and now and then we see a spark, but there's so much out there we don't know, so we got a lot of things to do to define all these things. And that's all there is on the pheromones tonight, because we're going to chapel.